Well, good morning. This is Chair Rita Moran. Pursuit of House Rule 10.01, I call this remote meeting of the House Ways and Means Committee to order. The clerk would take the roll.
Representative Moran?
Present.
Moran, present. Representative Olson?
Present.
Olson, present. Representative Garofalo? Representative Albright?
Present.
Albright, present. Representative Becker Finn?
Present.
Becker Finn, present. Representative Bernardi?
Present.
Bernardi, present. Representative Eklund?
Present.
Eklund, present. Representative Hansen?
Hansen, present.
Hansen, present. Representative Hassan, excused. Representative Hertaus? Representative Hornstein?
Hornstein, present.
Hornstein, present. Representative Johnson?
Present.
Johnson, present. Representative Kreisha?
Kreisha, present.
Kreisha, present. Representative Liebling?
Present.
Liebling, present. Representative Lilly?
Morning, Lilly, present.
Lilly, present. Representative Mariani?
Mariani, present.
Mariani, present. Representative Marquardt?
Marquardt, present.
Marquardt, present. Representative Miller?
Present.
Miller, present. Representative Nash?
Nash, present.
Nash, present. Representative Nelson? Representative Noor?
Noor, present.
Noor, present. Representative O'Neill? Representative Pawlowski?
Present.
Pawlowski, present. Representative Petersburg?
Present.
Petersburg, present. Representative Pinto?
Present.
Pinto, present. Representative Schumacher?
Schumacher, present.
Schumacher, present. Representative Schultz?
Present.
Schultz, present. Representative Scott?
Present.
Scott, present. Representative Sundin?
Sundin, present.
Sundin, present. Representative Garofalo? Representative Hertaus?
Hertaus, present.
Hertaus, present. Representative Nelson? Representative O'Neill. A quorum is present.
Thank you. So members, in the hearing materials you received in the email from Mr. McCall, you should find the committee rules for this session. Most of these rules should look familiar, but I do want to draw members' attention to rules 6 and 10. We will have a unifying deadline of noon on the business day before hearings for filing amendments and handouts. So for our regularly scheduled Monday hearings, that deadline will be on Fridays. As we pick up our pace later in the session, the agendas, when agendas may be posted with less notice, staff will alert the committees if these deadlines will be relaxed for any bills to ensure that members have enough time to prepare. Is there any questions on the committee rules? Okay.
Madam Chair, I think Representative Garofalo's hand is up.
Madam Chair, did you recognize me?
Yes, Representative Garofalo, please.
Thank you. Madam Chair, in the past, under previous chairs, the Ways and Means Committee has approached the amendment process with flexibility, where sometimes it's necessary for the majority to make changes inside the deadlines. And while you don't seek the consent of the minority party, usually you keep us well informed. Is it fair to say that those traditional practices will continue throughout this session?
Representative Garofalo, it is fair to say that we will keep that practice.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Absolutely. Our next agenda item is approval of the minutes for my hearing on Monday, January the 11th. The minutes were included in the hearing documents emailed to you by the staff. Are there any questions or comments? Not the chair will entertain a motion.
So move, Madam Chair, if you haven't had that.
Representative Knorr moves approval of the minutes for January the 11th, 2020. Can you please unmute briefly for a voice vote? All in favor of approving the minutes, say aye.
Aye.
Thank you. All opposed? The motion prevails and the minutes are approved.
Madam Chair, we're still having some difficulties with your microphone.
I will try to move closer to get better.
Getting better. May need to get a headset or something with a microphone directly on you. It's still coming across a little blurry.
How about that?
Keep going. That sounds like it might be better.
Is that better for you now?
Madam Chair, if I may offer a suggestion, if you have other computer programs running in the background outside of Zoom, you may want to close those. Likewise, if you can cut your video feed and just go audio only, those are things that have worked for me in the past.
Very good. You know, this is kind of like those nightmares that happens, but we would get through this and it would be okay. Is that a little bit better?
Quite a bit.
Right. All right, thank you. So we're going to move into the presentation, but before I do that, I just want to just give us some highlights and remembrance of how we came to have this select committee. So back in the summer of 2020, the legislature passed a resolution declaring racism is a healthcare crisis. And from that resolution, the Select Committee on Racial Justice was formed. I want to acknowledge that I understand I'm presenting on a subject that can be very uncomfortable. Racism is not a subject area that brings comfort, but I'm asking each one of you, each one of us, to create a space today to listen, to learn, and to sit in your uncomfortability for a moment. You know, I'm a city girl to the core, and early in my legislative journey, like my first term, I realized that there were issue areas that I was not versed in because, you know, I didn't have the experience or it wasn't my experience, insight, or expertise. Early, I realized that I didn't know much about rural Minnesota. You know, we're always having this urban-rural debate that goes on. So I had to listen and learn and become more informed because I knew early in this process that I shouldn't and I couldn't speak for rural Minnesota, nor did I have the solutions for rural Minnesota. It was really clear to me. So as you may know, Minnesota is leading in disparities. Since my tenure here in the legislature, we have been talking about disparities. We've been admiring disparities. We have data that shows disparities between Black, Indigenous, and people of color and white Minnesotans. Even as we pass policies and laws year after year and balance the budget every 2 years, disparities increase. Personally, I'm really tired of admiring the disparities. And I'm hoping you guys are too. And I hope through the work of the Select Committee on Racial Justice that you would get some insight into the problems and solutions as policymakers. Today's presentation is just a short introduction into the report. I ask that everyone take the time to read the report yourself, including the public that is listening to this hearing today. It's only a 45-page document. And so let's begin with the presentation. So a little history again on the Select Committee. We declared racism to be a public health crisis affecting all Minnesotans. We authorized the Select Committee on Racial Justice. It establishes several avenues through which the House of Representatives can actively begin to dismantle racism. We're hoping that we'll be able to collaborate with agencies and communities to ensure equitable administration of public safety. We establish and review and reform existing house policies and practices to advance equity with measurable outcomes. Assess all internal house processes related to human resources and vendor selections. Enhance data-driven education on impacts of racism. To support local, regional, and federal initiatives to dismantle systemic racism. We adopt similar solutions by the governor and the Senate. Next. So we held 6 informational hearings, September through December. It was co-chaired by myself and Representative Ruth Richardson, with Vice Chair Representative Lisa Damon. We had discussions on definitions. It was really important to us that we kind of introduce definitions so that we can have a common language, because often these are definitions that are being utilized in many different ways. We create a historical framework and current data regarding systemic racism and disparities. We had experts who came in to testify, local experts, but also some national experts, especially around the definition of racism. We had public testimonies from across Minnesota and the United States. Our focus on disparity in specific policy fields for Black, Indigenous, and people of color, which you will sometimes hear me use the word BIPOC instead of Black, Indigenous, and people of color. But our focus was around economics, housing, education, health, and public safety. And a draft report was released at our last hearing on December the 22nd, 2020. And the final report was released today, January the 25th, 2021. So I thought this was a good opening into our definitions. And by Albert Einstein, who said, if I had an hour to solve a problem, I'd spend 55 minutes thinking about the problem and 5 minutes thinking about the solution. So what this means is that we have these great disparities that, or problems that we focus on. And I don't know if many of you remember the little story I told about the young people walking through the forest and came upon a river and they saw the babies and they all ran to grab the babies, right? Because that was the immediate problem. And so we need to think longer, that the problem, but get to the root causes of the problem and not just what is in front of us. But they ran uphill to find out why the babies continue to come down. And then 5 minutes thinking about the solution. So I hope that makes sense for folks. So how to frame constructive discussion around race and racism. And so we know that we have individuals that we sometimes call racist or, people who discriminate and they have their biases and, we know prejudice exists. But for the purpose of the work that we do in the Minnesota House of Representatives as legislators, our focus around racism would be around systemic racism, institutional racism. We're going to remove all the individual connotations of racism and let our work in the House embody systemic and institutional racism. So racism is a system. It's not an individual character flaw or a personal moral failing. It is a system of power that structures opportunity, whether it's in education, housing, job, or justice. And it also assigns value. Who is worthy and who is unworthy? Who is full of potential or who is full of menace? Based on so-called race, the social interpretation of how we look. Next. So systemic racism has three critical impacts on society. It unfairly disadvantages some individuals and community. It unfairly advantages other individuals and community. And most importantly, what it does is that it saps the strength of a whole society by wasting human resources. So internalized racism. Internalized racism is how we absorb social messaging about race, adopting them as personal belief and biases. It can create a feeling of superiority or entitlement and prejudice. But people can also internalize oppression by believing negative messages about their own racial groups. Institutional racism, racial inequity within institutions and systems of power. Institutional racism, again, is about racial inequities within institutions and systems of power around employment, who gets fired, who gets let go, who get promoted, who don't get promoted, government and social services. It can take the form of unfair policies, discriminatory treatment, or inequitable opportunities and outcomes, institutional racism. So the Select Committee on Race and Justice, one of our final findings was that we are all adversely impacted by the system of racism. And we all have a role to play in addressing the adverse impacts. It's not me, it's not the legislative, it's the legislative of color. It's about all of us having a role to play. Equality is providing every person with the same things to enjoy a full, healthy life. On the other side is equity, which is mean understanding and providing what each person needs to enjoy a full, healthy life. Now, both of these models promote fairness and justice, but equality can only succeed if everyone starts with the same opportunity. For example, I love visuals, so I'm hoping we can get these visuals here. So here we have, you know, a giving tree. Abundance of apples. And it says inequality. As we can see, you know, as this tree leans to the left, we see that there's an abundance of apples on that side. And so we see there's some unequal access to this opportunity. So if you want to just have some equality, you know, We say sometimes as legislators in this body, well, we're going to give everyone equal access or the same thing. For our schools, we're going to give them, you know, we're going to raise, student per person across the board for everyone, right? Equality, equally. Even distribute tools and assistance. But here we see here, we'll make it equal because this tree is leaning towards the left. that the access to these apples is more, still more accessible to the young person when I left. Equity is a custom tool that identify and address the inequality. So as you see, you know, the young person on the right needed a longer ladder to get access to the apple. But the tree is still doing what? Curving to the left. And so justice is fixing the system to offer equal access to both tools and opportunity. So we had to put a couple of little, you know, pieces of the woods up there and get that tree a little bit more, to get it balanced, to straighten it up, so that access to education, access to, you know, minority businesses, access to, it looks more fair and just. Inclusion. Inclusion is the action or state of including or of being included within a group or structure. More than simply diversity in numerical representation, you know, where we say, well, we want to hire just more diverse people of color. And because now we have, instead of one person of color in here, we have five, so we've done our job. But inclusion really involves an authentic and empowered participation and a true sense of belonging. That's inclusion. Next. So we realized that during our presentation of bringing in, you know, some national people who was really versed in using local folks, that it's really important that we focus on Minnesota. So we want to, you know, bring it back home and talk about the Minnesota paradox. And the Minnesota paradox is a tale of two states, with specific groups of Minnesotans experience a high quality of life and other groups of Minnesotans experiencing poor outcomes and persistent racial disparities. And so my hope is that as we move forward, and as we, I think we have a video that is going to be shown shortly here, is that the tale of the two states is a tale of, and I would let you figure that out as you see the video. But it is not so encompassing of, you know, it is my fault, with her fault, they're not working as hard, they, you know, they don't, you know, this is not about the individual. So I just want to just move us away from that piece a little bit more, again, to move us into the inequities, the tale of the two states. Next. So the Select Committee on Racial Justice final reports highlighted this, that we saw that there was persistent and unacceptable racial disparities in Minnesota. The research findings on the rate of racial disparities and the underlying causes, there are absolutely research-based findings on underlying causes of structural racism. In a historical context of government sanctioned policies and practices that facilitated an unequal playing field, which means that there was laws and policies that was created by legislatures across this state, across this country, at the federal level and at the state level, that created and facilitated an unequal playing field. So we need solutions to reduce and eliminate racial disparities. So racial disparities they're not statistics. They are the lived stories of Minnesotans in BIPOC communities. Racial disparities are the real harms and trauma inflicted by historical laws and policies. And racial disparities are a multi-generational legacy. They are handed down from generation to generations to generations. So we can, there are solutions. And I hope as chair that I may say this as chair of Ways and Means, and my priority and goals for us is to bring solutions to the table. Sustainable solutions require a ground floor investment, not band-aid fixes. It is not, you know, well, let's do this one project for now. Hopefully it won't be so cumbersome that you're saying, well, why do we have to do that? Like, you know, racial equity is a lens through which we can view all policies and budget decisions. There are opportunities to tackle disparities throughout the state budget. There are great opportunities. And I love this quote and this visual here, is that racial disparities is not the frosting on top of this cupcake over here. It is not something that, you know, well, okay, let's do this. But tackling equity is not the frosting on top of the cupcake, but it is the butter in the batter. It is what we do and how we do. It is not something extra that we think we may need to do and not need to do. It is how we, is how I will hope that we will operate as legislators in the Minnesota House of Representatives through our equity lens that is embedded in who we are and what we do and how we do it. Next. Racial disparities in economic security. When we talk about systemic racism sapping the strength of the whole society, that includes the reality that systemic racism is expensive. It is costing our state and our country millions, trillions of dollars when we do not invest in people's lives, in community lives, in a fair and equitable way. At the top, you see a wonderful restaurant here in the district that I represent in the Rondo community. You know, we see the Mural Osset and some of the great work that's been done by Native Americans and also in the Latino community who are investing in as small business owners, you know, as a livelihood. So the national economic impact of discrimination over the last 20 years has looked something like this. $16 trillion of forfeited economic production, the GDP. 6.1 million jobs were not created that could help families and communities to be more self-sufficient. Racial disparities created a $287 billion wealth gap for BIPOC Minnesotans. $22 billion in lost income from the wage gap, because we start off at a disadvantage with our wages. $174 billion in lost lifetime earnings from educational opportunity and skill gaps. Twin City household earnings for the median Black income is 38, while the median income for a white family is 84 plus. $24 billion from lower house ownership rates, higher rent, and higher property taxes. $67 billion in lost revenue from a capital gap. Disparities persist in state procurement. I think we are in procurement somewhere around maybe one point something, in contracting for minority-owned businesses. And so to kind of like help us get some insight when I say that racist disparities exist, inequity exists, and it's not just about an individual shortfalling, I would like for us to just look at the housing, what went on here in Minnesota, just around housing for this moment. So let's start, Mr. McCall.
And now, through the use of a National Housing Act insured mortgage, is brought within the reach of all citizens on a monthly payment.
In the midst of the New Deal, when the FDR administration is looking for ways to try to stabilize the housing market, the Fair Housing Act is passed in 1934. And as part of that, the Homeowners Loan Corporation is also established with the hope that if you could establish long-term mortgages with fixed interest rates, you could create pathways to homeownership for most Americans.
This time they can buy this house with monthly payments that are less than they now spend for rent.
When the FHA starts underwriting mortgages in the 1930s, this really is a game changer in a lot of ways. It takes a lot of risk off the banks, it places it onto the federal government, and now working class, middle class families, they're able to purchase a home.
Unfortunately, as part of that, what the HOLC does is it establishes designations for neighborhoods based on the occupants of those neighborhoods.
And this is where the term redlining comes into place. The FHA, they made color-coded maps of all the largest cities in the United States, and they broke cities down into four different areas. Red is considered hazardous, that's the worst. Yellow is considered definitely declining. Blue is considered still desirable. And green is considered the best.
And what's so powerful about this kind of scale of measuring investment, it was about values and people.
The fact of the matter is that there was no evidence that those people who lived in those communities, predominantly black and brown people and foreign-born people, would have defaulted on loans.
There are no firm realities behind the close proximity to blackness and your property values going down. That's just not true.
The FHA is being very upfront and very explicit in how they're linking spatial desirability with racial occupancy. It's this racialization of space idea. So areas that were predominantly African-American or majority minority, or really in a lot of cases, even if there's a few non-white people there, that's often enough to be redlined. So when they built these maps, they also explained why each area got the ranking it did.
The area around 4th Avenue South, which is called the Old South Side, this was a nice area. It had nice homes. It's the historic African-American neighborhood on the south side of Minneapolis.
This one part of South Minneapolis was redlined specifically due to, and I'm quoting, a gradual infiltration of Negroes and Asiatics. The FHA refused to give an area a green-lined designation. Again, this is the best designation that they'll offer unless, and I'm quoting again, restrictive covenants are already in place. That line's from the FHA underwriting manual. Racial covenants aren't just about discriminating against people of color. It's about enriching white people. And I think that's the part that often gets lost in this narrative. And I think it does speak to the ways that white supremacy have been embedded in really built structures and built environments. I mean, if your grandparents bought a home on Minnehaha Creek, you know, that home's worth, what, $500,000? If your grandparents rented an area that was redlined and then subsequently destroyed by a freeway project, you know, you're not inheriting anything.
In a lot of ways, the practice of redlining, which didn't start until the 1930s, institutionalized and spread racial covenants all over the country, because suddenly developers got sanctioned, they got direction from the federal government saying, this is best practices. If you want to have a really high rating from us, if you want to get the most favorable terms for any loans.
By kind of deintegrating Minneapolis, which in many ways is what racial covenants are doing, this set the stage and enabled all these subsequent systems of inequality to really take hold.
This very persistent myth that northern cities never had formal segregation. The South had Jim Crow, and look at those signs. Well, racial covenants did the work of Jim Crow in the North, all over the North.
Many
that is a we that is a longer documentary that I would I just suggest that on your own time that you just take some time to listen to it and see it. I think we did about 5 minutes or so of it. And so, in conclusion, it is imperative on the Minnesota legislature to make amends for past and present harms by prioritizing the enactment of laws and policies designed to address racial disparities and expand access to opportunity to build a prosperous state for all Minnesotans. And so you have a to your right, this picture of Governor Walz signing a bipartisan piece of legislation that created a path for parents who had lost their children to the child protection system. And instead of those children being put into a loving home, they are living and aging out of a system. When parents are able to go on and make their lives better, there was no way for them to stretch back and get their kids out of that system and take them home and be a part of a loving family and community. But it was a bipartisan bill that was signed that now allows parents the possibility to get their parental rights back and to bring their children or child home to be connected to a loving family in a loving and strong community. The Select Committee on Racial Justice concluded that systemic racism exists, that systemic racism is harmful, and that systemic racism must be addressed. The Select Committee recommendations, they are not a checklist to end systemic racism. There's a lot of them. But for those who feel like, you know, what did that mean and what did that look like in policy that create practices back out in our community and town across the state of Minnesota, the recommendations are there for that. Improving racial equity is a perpetual goal. It's not a one and done solution. Committees should view reports as a springboard for fall 22-23 budget discussions. Make space in agendas to consider proposals that acutely address disparities. Assess legislation through a lens of intersectional racial equity. And be aware of how policy choices could disproportionately impact Pacific communities or lack of a budget choice. And so that is the end of the presentation. I love this quote here that says, and yes, we are far from polished, far from pristine, but that doesn't mean that we are striving to form a union that is perfect. We are striving to forge our union with purpose, to compose a country committed to all cultures and colors and characters and condition of man. And so we lift our gaze not to what stands between us, but what stands before us. We close the divide because we know to put our future first, we must first put our differences aside. We lay down our arms so that we can reach out our arms to one another. We seek harm to none and harmony for all. Amanda Gorman, young 22-year-old young Black woman. And so I would like to just stop here and would like to open it up for questions and a discussion. I think we have a little time. So I'm willing and I'm hoping that you will have some questions and that we can have a discussion around the presentation. Thank you so much, everyone, so much for listening and giving this some time in this committee. I open it up for questions. Can you guys hear me?
Yes, looks like Representative Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to say more of a comment and then a question that I really appreciated that we're however many weeks into session and that this was a choice of the Ways and Means Chair to have this important discussion in this space, and for the recommendations and how it can be implemented throughout all of our work, and to the point in the slide about not just the icing on the top, that by the time things come to Ways and Means, that they've already had those discussions. So I was wondering, I think it was really great, you know, what you hope to see, Madam Chair, as things comes into Ways and Means, and some of the just hopes you have as bills move through this committee, and how you can see that this important work is a part of it, because it is so important, and I'm glad we're having it here, but we know that a lot of this will also happen in the committee space too. So thank you for bringing this here, and thank you for this discussion.
Thank you, Representative Olson. And you're right, you know, one of my purpose of bringing this early is because the work happens. It's going to happen in committees, right? We you know, my priority and my goal is for us at the end of session is to have a balanced budget. That is critical. That we have a balanced budget. And I know we have great chairs leading and great members, and I believe we can do this. But, and I saw to be necessary in the early of this process for us as those who are chairs and for members to, you know, look at the bills that you're moving through the body and will be a final part of any omnibus bill, and be able to say, because I will be asking when they come into Ways and Means, you know, how did this impact, you know, racial equity? How does this reduce disparities, you know, and how does it do no harm? And so that would be a regular question that I will be asking, because I think it's important in this moment in time.
I think we have Representative Kreshaw next.
All right. Thank you, Chair Moran. Thank you for the question. So you invited a conversation, which I'm happy to be part of. I did read through the document. Thank you for that. Thank you for the work of the Select Committee. And your perspective, passion, experience is very critical to addressing disparities. I hope that what you said is that we've moved past the conversation that this exists or doesn't exist, just to a conversation of let's look at the solutions and let's find places where we can apply thoughtful deliberations about reducing racial disparities. I agree with everything you said about that. So what I'm interested in for my own benefit is we're all representing our own areas. We're all looking at priorities. We're all trying to find solutions for the conversations that we have with constituents. And you just you alluded to that you're going to apply a racial lens to all of those conversations, which, again, I'm just setting expectations here. I want to understand. So if I understand this, the intent of the document is to declare and address racism as a public health crisis and ensure House legislative efforts are analyzed through an intersectional racial equality lens. Would that be fair? I'm trying to get the expectations of the chair.
Yes, through race equity means.
Okay, so knowing that, and this helps me as I talk to constituents and people that bring issues forward, that this is one of the considerations we need to bring forward. Can you tell me, or at least point me of your expectations, how will this document help the Ways and Means members analyze issues and those intersection points with racial inequities? For example, more precisely, will every vote we take account for that intersection point of racial inequity? Will that be a factor for all the votes? Are we going to apply it broadly?
So I wouldn't say, you know, I never use words like every and always or never. I don't do that because every circumstance is different. And nothing is always, and nothing is never, never in my mind.
Madam Chair, I think the microphone's cutting out a little bit again.
Okay. So what I will be doing is asking the question why when it reads Ways and Means. But there are lots of conversation. There will be lots of testify. There will be lots of bills that will be moving through committees. And that is where the real work in the conversation is going to happen, right? And my hope is that, you know, when I ask that question, that, you know, the chairs or committee members, you know, the chairs can answer that question because they have thought it through.
Madam Chair?
Yes. Representative?
Just follow up when you're ready.
Yeah. Representative Creason. Go ahead. Yeah.
So thank you, Madam Chair. So, and again, I'm really just trying to understand this. So what you said there is you're not going to apply this broadly. With all due respect, you are the chair of the Ways and Means Committee, which is one of the most powerful committees. In order to get things accomplished and appropriated, they're going to need your approval. So can you help me understand when that would be applied and when it wouldn't, which is important to know? Because, I mean, if what you're saying to me is you'll pick subjectively when we're going to use this lens and when we're not, that creates unclear expectations of when, like, for example, if I'm to bring an issue forward, how am I going to know when to make that argument, when not to make that argument? When is it going to be applied to help me? When is it not going to be applied? I think having that clarity will help anybody that brings an issue forward because, as you know, when there's fog at the pulpit, there's mist in the pews. If we don't really understand how this is going to be applied, that makes it hard for us to actually accomplish the bills that we may want to bring forward. So thoughts on that?
Yeah, let me try to be clear because I didn't understand that, what you just said, right? I couldn't visualize that neither.
Yep.
Oh, right. So what I am hoping, because most of the members that are on Ways and Means are chairs of committee, right? And I believe this is not about just my responsibility. You know, I can be, you know, as people have shared with me that Ways and Means chair is all powerful, I can probably, you know, try to exert all power. But I think this is not just about me. I think this is about the chairs of different committees, you know, to also, you know, and I'm hoping the short presentation that I gave, and I'm hoping everyone will read, you know, to become more informed. You know, I talked earlier about I am a city girl. I am a city girl to the core. And you know, Patricia, I might not know much about your district, how it operate, what it looked like, but you do, right? And so there are some things that I cannot lead on, and I may let others lead on it. For many, many years, the legislative body was not a very diverse body. For many years, it wasn't all women here neither, right? It was just a man's thing. But when women come into the space, we see things differently. We legislate, we create bills through our perspective about how we believe that our state needs to move forward. And so right now in Minnesota history, we have in the Minnesota House of Representatives 17 legislators of color who bring their experience, their lived experience, their work, knowledge, expertise into this body. And so when you don't know something because it doesn't represent your district, we have to learn to be open up to talk to other people and listen and learn from them about things that we don't know about, that we can't visualize because it hasn't ever been part of who we are. So in short, it is my expectation that chairs will take the lead on this in their respective committee. That's the journey that we do here in this legislative body. It defines its way to Ways and Means. So by the time it comes to Ways and Means, you know, it's not like every bill is going to be, you know, it's going to be, you know, interpreted and scrutinized by me. But by the time it comes to Ways and Means, and, you know, I'm in a big way, I am just that committee where bills come so they can get into a budget or go to the House floor. But by that time, it is my hope that the chairs of different committees have brought an equity lens into their committee in some way, because we have huge disparities, because we all know what distant learning right now has done to our educational system. And this pandemic has did nothing more than exacerbate the disparities, right? And so that is, education is foundational. And so my hope is that there may be some things that you wonder, you know, well, why we gotta do it that way? Well, because we have lived experiences that is moving and driving the way that we believe is going to help our children move forward, right? Just as you would say, you know, this might not be what you need, but farmers need this. And so I'm hoping I'm being a little bit closer and clearer to my expectations is that my hope is that the chairs of committees would take the lead to bring the equity lens through that body as legislators are bringing bills forward to be heard, to be introduced, that would get to the meat of what we need to do to move our states, to move our communities, to move our town across the state of Minnesota to better outcomes.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Representative.
A couple more follow-ups?
Yes.
Thank you. Oh, and so thank you for that. Okay, so I understand and I appreciate it. So you're going to ask your chairs to apply this lens down to their committees. And I am being intentionally particular because, as you know, in order to get things done in the legislature, you need to know how decisions are going to be made. That is legislating 101. So, for example, and there are areas in my district where we deal with lots of different popularities or populations. Certainly, in some of my towns, the disparities exist in Latinos. And I acknowledge that. We need to work on that. I see that. There are other areas where it's not so clear. Let me give you an example. You're saying that we're going to apply this lens down to the committee chairs, ask the committee chairs to then apply this lens on the behalf and look for those intersection points. So one example in my community is we're trying to build an overpass for a railroad. That would go through the transportation committee. It seems a little bit strange as I'm asking this, but do I need to figure out the intersection point of racial equity on that and how I can justify that through racial equity impact statements? In other words, how would I satisfy that criteria to get that in front of the transportation committee chair who could then say, yep, you've looked at the impacts and the intersection points of racial equity, and now I can move that on. How do I accomplish that given what's laid out in front of us?
So maybe, and I'll give you an example. You know, across Minnesota, across this country, you know, when there was this concept that we want to move people from one point to the next point. And across this country, and including in Minnesota, and in this event, the highway went through our Black community. That's an impact. We know historically that wealth was defined by home ownership. But all those homes and businesses in that community was demolished. And we're still recovering from that. So I just say a little short that maybe you need to look and through an equity lens, it doesn't have an impact. Would it disproportionately impact the Latino community or community or low-income community? Maybe it will, maybe it don't. I don't know, but at least you're thinking about it now, right? Instead of just doing it, like, you know, because you think it's a good thing. And maybe it probably is, maybe it is. But I'm asking you to dig a little deeper.
And Madam Chair?
Yes.
And that's fair, and this is helpful. So, I mean, in an example like that, where I'm looking at mortality rates, I'm looking at economic retail shops, how that might affect businesses that may move in, including those businesses that are minority-owned. But in the scheme of that, would there ever be a situation where my project would be up against a similar project, and because I'm not going through a neighborhood of color, I could be put on second tier or below and not funded? Is that a possibility with this racial lens that is being applied here?
So I guess, Krisha, what I can say is that the work in coming to the Ways and Means Committee is about our overall budget work. You know, it's not so minute that I'm focusing on every bill. This is about the large budget bills
okay.
that come before us. And I'm not monitoring, it's trying to monitor, I think, you know, one else is trying to monitor every little bill.
Okay, so.
Moving through the body. Who has time for that? I don't. So it's more in general about the overall budget bills. And embedded within the overall budget bills, Representative Freeshaw. Your overpass is probably so necessary right now, right? But yes.
Okay. Okay, Madam Chair, just a couple more.
Well, let's do.
And I don't want to eat up all the time.
But you know what? I'm excited. I am excited that you had questions, because my biggest fear that it would not have been any questions, right? And so this is, you know, okay, I think we have a little time.
And yep, manager. And yeah, in no way, I really do. I did read the document. I want to understand it. I want to know how you're going to use this document to achieve the goals and the perspectives and that you have witnessed and are expressing to us that needs to be solved. I totally acknowledge that. I want to know how I help you accomplish that goal. So what I need to know is, how do I apply intersection points, economic impact statements to bills to make sure that they are accomplishing the goal that you're laying out? I mean, for example, and I'll just give you two more examples and let you respond to these, and then I can end my line of questioning. But are we going to see something along the lines of like a fiscal note, which is what we use here for a racial impacts note? For example, would there ever be a time we might have a document that's objective and done by a third party saying, hey, here's the racial impact? And if so, I would just like to know, so I know how that document's written, so we know what goes into it. And then second things I noticed, a number of things were put in this document about education, but I could find nowhere where there was the achievement gap specifically mentioned or reduced. So that would be just something that I think we should circle back on. I know you've been a proponent of the constitutional amendment to increase equity education. I'm certainly a huge proponent of that, and I would like to work with you to move that. I think that could be one of the biggest things to move the needle forward for all kids. And so those are my last two. I appreciate the document. If it makes you happy, and I hope it does, I have read the document. It's important, and I want to continue the conversations.
Beautiful. Is there a question in there for me? Representative,
please. Just the two, would we see a note down the road, like a racial impact note? Oops, am I still muted?
No, I can hear you. Well, first, let me just say that I have carried that bill before. You know,
okay.
I've done that in the past. And I know right. Representative Paul Thiessen went here in the legislature. He also carried that bill. And I, you know, personally think it would be helpful. So I wouldn't be surprised if we were to see a bill like that being introduced. You know, I don't think it's the worst thing in the world if it was. I just want members to know this about me, that I recognize that not every bill needs to go through a racial equity note or is about racial equity. I also know that I am not just a district legislator. We are called state legislators. And the state and the well-being of every child, family, community, and town is important, because we are interconnected. So I want us to be clear about that, that I see all of us. I do. But I think we have some work as a body to be able to say that too. And so, because without it, I just think we fall short. Yep. And so.
Okay, so I'll just follow up. I think I encapsulated your last conversation. So what I would say this is, it sounds to me what you're trying to accomplish is that we think more deeply about projects, we apply this lens, and we have that conversation. I would offer on the other side, I would hope that members never feel like this issue is used against them, because there's lots of ways
to kill ideas and kill bills down here. So I would just hope that we would never use this as a way to ruin, to move out good ideas for political reasons. I'm not saying that's your intent. I'm just putting that out there as the other side of this coin of saying, let's make sure we don't use it for that either, and let's use it for what you're intending, which is to really talk about the racial disparities that exist.
There's room for lots and lots of ideas. I just want us to be all inclusive to begin to think about something that traditionally we wouldn't, because it's not our lived experience, right? Or we know how to talk about it or deal with it. And so my hope is your hope. I mean, your hope is my hope.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
And if you have questions,
thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Prechot, let's do a one-on-one. My office, you have my phone number. You have my number. Text me, and let's continue this conversation, okay?
Representative Moran, we've never had a challenge talking to each other. Right. I don't foresee that becoming an issue.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Thank you. Is there any other questions?
Yes, Madam Chair. I think we have Representative Becker Finn next.
Yes, Representative Becker Finn.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And, you know, I was one of the members that was lucky enough to serve on the select committee with your leadership and Representative Richardson. And I think it's really important to clarify that this isn't asking folks to read this report and really try to internalize what is contained in this report. It's not like we're enacting an affirmative action policy on bills. That isn't the goal at all. I think, you know, the goal is that when folks read this report, that it's more than just a thing you checked off your list that you were supposed to read, and that you take away from it more than that it contains the word racism in the report. You know, it's really thinking deeply about how our policies, you know, for centuries have gotten us to this point where the disparities exist, and we are now being called to do something about it. And I know, as a chair of my committee, you know, the goal for me, what this will look like is that, you know, if members bring a bill to my committee, they should expect to address whether there is an impact disproportionately on different communities and what that impact is, or does this address an underlying disparity? I think those are the ways, you know, sort of to speak to the previous questioning of things that I think members can start to expect by knowing that this is a priority of the Ways and Means Chair, is that we should be asking those questions and including those answers maybe before they're even asked in our presentations of bills. And I think the goal is to sort of internalize all these things that we're talking about so that it's a thing that we're all thinking about every day as we're doing our work. Because what we know, and we know in reading the report and through all the testimony, is that these things don't just impact our BIPOC communities, they impact entire communities, because we are losing out on all of the great things that those members of our community can contribute when we disproportionately have systems that impact them negatively. And as an example that maybe this is helpful is that, you know, I've served on the Environment Committee for many years with Representative Fisher. And he shared with me after a couple years that I had asked so many times in committee, you know, have you talked to the tribes about this? What do tribal communities think about this? That now Representative Fisher thinks about that even when I'm not in that room, because he sort of internalized that that's an important thing to ask about and to think about. And so that's, I think that really to me in the work we did on this committee was the goal. That, you know, folks will sort of internalize this and make it an important piece of the work that we do every day, instead of, you know, as your example, you know, not like, oh, I'm putting the sprinkles on, shoot, I forgot to think about this. You know, it's more of a thing that we're thinking about on a routine basis and that we really internalize. And so I thank you for drawing attention to this. I think it really is remarkable that we finally gotten to this point. And I hope that, you know, I haven't spoken to every chair of every committee, but I hope that's how other chairs are thinking about ways to bring this work into what we do every day. So just wanted to share that comment to someone who sat on that the select committee and heard all the testimony and was part of seeing the report come together that I think might be helpful for others here on this committee. So thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Becker-Fan, for that additional insight into the work of the select committee and what that means and how it can be implemented for us within the Minnesota House of Representatives.
Next, we have Representative O'Neill.
Representative, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. As the presentation was going along, it kind of spurred some thoughts, and I just wanted to share a few insights. When I was on the committee with Representative Bernardi for higher education, we had an interesting conversation about the pipeline program, which is kind of a dual training model. It was something that Senator Bonhoeff and I created back in 2015, I believe it was. And it essentially is if you are employed at, a manufacturing facility and you're a lower level employee and you want to be a CNC, so then you can enroll in the program and the company will pay half your tuition and this grant program will pay half the tuition for you to get the training to be a CNC. And so we were talking about that program and how successful it was. And Representative John Thompson had an interesting question in relation to this. And I thought this, as you were going through the whole presentation, this came back to my memory. And he was talking about his community and how they really struggle when there's a lot of government and regulatory red tape. And of course, we all do. But he pointed out in particular that his community really struggles when there's heavy-handed government regulations and red tape. And so thankfully the answer back was it's a less than a page application, and actually the business is the one that does the majority of the work. And the employee then becomes a student and does very little. I think it's like a half a page application. And so something really practical that we can think about is anytime that we're streamlining heavy government regulations, anytime that we are making entry into things easier, not harder, for example, the pipeline program, those are all things that help anybody that's sort of on the outside looking in, whether it's because of their community, because of their race, their education, or whatever it is. So as you were talking about all this, it just kind of came to mind, and I could think of like 100 other things really that we can look at that type of lens, but I think it's really important to make things simpler, not harder, particularly when you talk about what agencies are requiring from businesses, what institutions are requiring, so like a higher ed institution from their students, make it easier, not harder, simpler, not or complicated, and cut the red tape. And I think that would help everybody that's sort of on the outside looking in. I have one other quick example too, since we have a little bit of time, but there was a rest area on 35 that was torn down and was in the process of being rebuilt. And, you know, we have requirements that they get multiple bids when they're gonna build something for the state of Minnesota. And it came to the attention of the representatives and senators in the area that while that process was done, really the bid was just given to the same people that always get it. You know, the same company that always gets it. Yep. So that kind of came to light. Like, you know, anytime that we can make that process real and not just checking a box and opening it up, because there was another company that did apply. And because they hadn't made this, because they hadn't built something that was over 2 million in the recent year, they were excluded. But they had built those types of buildings all the time. They just hadn't done it in the previous year. So all of these little tiny boxes that we require people to check off excludes more people than it includes. We have we really need to think about expanding and opening up these opportunities to say a new entrepreneur, whether it be a person of color or not. I think it's across the board for anybody that's new and on the outside looking in. And lots of times I'm guessing that probably has to do with race and probably, you know, other factors as well. But there's so many opportunities for us to make things easier and not more difficult and whatever it is we're doing, and making the whole process of bidding actually real and not just checking a box. So those are some of my thoughts as we came through this, and I do serve on three other committees, and so I'm excited to hear that those opportunities to really make things easier for people. So thank you so much for your presentation. I did read your report too, so I will keep that in mind as we're going through committees. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative O'Neill. Should I just say ditto, ditto, ditto? And you're right, you know, often we, there are cumbersome paperwork, and, you know, those who are a small business person, you know, those who get the access and the support comes and take, you know, and grab everything. You know, there are often same contractors, you know, and you're right, we don't enough open up and expand and create new opportunities. And what we do, we put burdens that those who are left out can become a burden, you know, on our town or our community or our state. But what I do believe, Representative O'Neill, is that you will endure the recommendation about streamlining state contract processes. I think that is something that we both can agree that it's something that we can pick up and do. Thank you. I think Representative Pinto has a question.
Yes, Madam Chair. Thank you so much to you and to everybody who put the time into those hearings, into the report. I was thinking this happened in the fall of 2020, and many of us had our minds not entirely on public policy every day of that time period. And of course, we all were coming in every 30 days for special sessions and all. But you and Representative Becker Finn on this call and others put in so much time and effort, and really appreciate it. And I was thinking about, my question is, and Madam Chair, you were gracious enough to have a one-on-one conversation with me last week, but this is partly maybe opening up to the other policy leads, the chairs and minority leads on this conversation about how we can have the members of our committee really have an understanding of the history and the background that you all unearthed. You know, we saw 5 minutes of that in the hearing today. But I was thinking about your Einstein quote about, you know, 55 minutes on the problem if you have only an hour to come up with a solution, and only 5 minutes on the solution, in reference to even to the railroad overpass proposal that Representative Preisha referenced. You know, that just understanding the basics of where we are as a state, and that may lead us to be thinking about, you know, why is a community in a given place, who owns the companies that may be hired to do the work on the railroad overpass, and how is it that that those particular, you know, who are the individuals who are owning that, and how did they come to be in that position? I don't know that we can expect, I think we should expect members to read the report, and if there are ways that we can work with one another to make sure that we have a real understanding of the dynamics, that feels really important to me. And we can do that committee by committee, but if there's some way or folks have ideas, certainly for me as chair of early childhood, I would love to hear it. And I'll finally just note that that the report does talk about educational disparities. There's a reference about this, and I'm really happy that it focuses a lot on home visiting, on early Head Start, on child care and early learning, subsidies and scholarships and support, recognizing that that's really where those disparities start. And the report calls that out and talks about the need to invest in that area, which I think is so important. So anyway, thank you so much. But if folks have ideas for me in particular and for us in general about how to make sure not just that we're thinking about the solutions, but really understanding the problem and why it is we are where we are today, boy, I'd love to get that that guidance. Thank you, Madam Chair.
But thank you, Representative Pinto, and thank you for uplifting those recommendations in early learning, because we know those, how critical those early years are to, you know, a child's success, educational success, and it starts so early. And so just thank you for that and for your work, and being so passionate for our youngest learners. Really, really do appreciate you. Do we have any other questions?
Yep, Madam Chair, we have Representative Knorr and then also Representative Mariani.
Representative Knorr.
Thank you so much, Madam Chair and members. And thank you for calling us to action. We know inequity is costly from unequal social, economic, and environmental conditions for what we know it's called social determinants of health. as you have heard before, tell me your zip code, I'll tell you your income, your education, your life expectancy, and your wealth. Members, this is something that we've known, that the persistence in the disproportionality and the gaps that exist in our state is significant. And for this report to come out and to ask us to take action, we have to. We know the cost of the issues that we have talked about. And just to give you a quick example, we know that COVID-19 has disproportionately impacted the BIPOC communities. We've lost our loved ones. We've seen many people losing their jobs. We've seen how the whole process of even vaccination, which is taking place right now. Those are not issues that can be solved by one person or one committee, but this is an action that we have to take. And I appreciate the chair for calling us to do something about it, rather than just admiring the problems that we have seen for many, many years. So one thing that I wanted to ask Madam Chair is, in relations to the public health, the pandemic that we are struggling with right now, as being our priority, how does this select committee recommendation really fit in into that conversation?
Representative Noah, I mean, it's foundational. We are in a current pandemic. You know, many have lost, lives have been lost, and it has really had a truly a big impact on our BIPOC community. And so as we begin to roll, because of underlying health factors and so much more. And so as we think about the equitable solutions for not exacerbating the inequities that we see in the loss of lives, that we have to be intentional about the vaccination process. You know, one of the things that our BIPOC caucus had to lead on was, like for many in our community, because of the history of America, don't always trust government. You know, even we put it in writing, we don't always seem to believe it. But we have, I trusted medias in our community who are the messengers of those messages so often. And so it is really incumbent on us as a state and state departments to continue to build on those relationships, to use local media that come from our community, trusted individuals in our community to help lead these conversations in the direction and the path that we need to go in. And we have some excellent recommendations that we put forth in the Select Committee report.
Okay, Madam Chair, and then we had Representative Mariani.
Representative Mariani.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for the committee members for the discussion. We're just scratching the surface, I recognize that. But I really appreciate the spirit of which everyone's engaged here. Madam Chair, I want to thank you for the expectations, quite frankly, that you have for us to be better legislators. I believe you're doing that by setting out expectations that allow us to update how and what we vet in this committee. Let me tell you a really quick story. It's got to be, oh my gosh, probably 20 years ago, I was approached during the period of time when our state was doing a big move to bring ethanol plants online. Most of that in greater Minnesota, where, you know, the corn is right there. It's being raised there, being grown there. But we had a brewery over on West 7th, the Schmidt Brewery, which was, my gosh, 120-30-year-old institution, which had been shuttered. And the proposal was to turn the West 7th Brewery into an ethanol plant. The infrastructure actually lent itself pretty neatly to be able to do that. We vetted that proposal. I was either a chief author or a main author, I can't recall now. It was in my district. we vetted the proposal. We carefully put it through all sorts of analysis around economic development, impact on local tax revenue, transportation issues of moving product in and out of the community. I mean, we did a really good job in the conventional way, conventional sense, of vetting that proposal. Well, flash forward a year or so, we authorized the ability of that to be converted. It was converted and discovered to our horror that we had created a major problem in the heart of St. Paul. It was so bad that the major problem on a summer or late spring day would waft its way through the windows at our state office building as we held committee hearings, sometimes even hearing rooms without windows. Anyone who knows anything about ethanol plants know that as remarkable and wonderful as they are, they also produce an have the potential to produce an incredible nuisance regarding air quality. To put it crudely, the air stunk really, really bad. It became so bad that it was a major public nuisance for the entire middle of our city, and obviously a quality of life issue for those living closest to the plant. It took us 3 years to undo the authorization because, you know, people had rightfully made investments and commitments, you know, based on the fact that we had vetted this and authorized this plant. You know, the moral of the story, members, is that sometimes, I mean, we're human. Sometimes we don't ask the questions that we need to ask, but we're nonetheless held accountable for asking those questions, even in hindsight. And I'm not going to quibble with that. As an elected official, rightfully so. I had no idea what that plant was going to do, but I totally had to own the consequences of our decision. And it seems to me, Madam Chair, that in the 21st century, in our nation, I mean, this has always been true, I believe, but I think more so now, racial equity is going to be increasingly be one of those absolutely vital core questions that we need to be asking in public policy and that we rightfully need to be held accountable. So, you know, this issue of racial equity is important in and of itself, stand alone. But it's also one way in which that offers us an opportunity to increase our quality of service as legislators by compelling us to add to all the other quality questions that we raise on both sides of the aisle about the merits and the benefits of any of our decisions that are made here. And so your proposal, your encouragement is to get us to ask the questions that we need to ask, that the public wants us to ask, that the public wants answers for. And I don't know all the answers. I mean, I'm kind of with Representative Grisha here. I don't know all, you know, what that is, but I can trust that together by committing to asking those questions that we'll find the best answers to that. So, Madam Chair, thank you for allowing me the time to share my little mini horror story here in St. Paul. And thank you for this encouragement and this proposal. I think it's vitally important in terms of modernizing our effectiveness as a legislature in the state of Minnesota.
Thank you, Representative Mariani. I just want to say thank you for your leadership. You are one of our longest standing legislators of color. And you've also been a great mentor for me. So I just want to say thank you for your role. And so, you know, I am one who believes that diversity is our strength. And it doesn't need or have to be something that we fear. because I know and I do believe that we all want communities and people to be self-sufficient and taking care of themselves and their family and not depending on the state. And I believe we can get there by looking at our work through a more equitable and fair lens, looking at laws and policies that create practices. And I know we can do it because Representative Mariana and myself worked on a police accountability bill that was very much bipartisan. And I know if we can do that with police accountability, that we can definitely do more and greater work within this body. So I have two goals as chair of the Ways and Means. One is to end this session with a balanced budget, right? And begin to have conversations that would help us to undo past and present inequities in our laws, in our practices. And we have to be intentional about building a state and a future that positions Minnesotans to lead the nation, that leads the nation in achieving racial equity. We have led for so much in around the country, and I believe we can do this here also in Minnesota. So I presented this report today and is asking you to be invested in this goal I'm setting for this year's budget. So let's continue to create space for discussion and learning so that going forward, we are all speaking, asking questions, inviting members from our diverse towns and communities across the state of Minnesota, going to those constituents of yours, listening to them, hearing from them, you know, expanding our own worldview. That's something that you have to do yourself. It's nothing that I can force or say what you need to do. It's up to you. But I'm hoping that we can all be called to be speaking a language around equity and about what the problems are and what we are trying to solve and how we are going to make it. We can do that.
Madam Chair, I'm sorry, we're have to interrupt, but we are losing your audio feed again. And I know we're close on time, but we do have a hand raised from Representative Scott if there's time.
Madam Chair, I'm sorry, did you call on me? I couldn't hear you.
I'm sorry. I hope that I didn't have all the information. So Representative Scott, please go ahead.
Okay, thank you. Well, Madam Chair, this is an issue that you and I have worked on for some time is the shared custody piece. And I think one of the things that I see missing from the subcommittee's work was just the fact that we need to do whatever we can to strengthen families and to see to it that kids have equal access to both parents when that's possible and when it's safe for them. And I feel like this has to be part of the conversation is just, again, strengthening the family in any way that we can. We know that the outcomes for kids in school are better when that is the case. And I think too that, and I don't have any data on this, but I'd be interested in knowing if there is any data on it, you know, of communities of color being treated differently in the courts as far as custody issues. I don't know that, like I said, I don't have any data, but I want to put that out there as a discussion point and something that I know you and I both care a great deal about. And so I'll just leave it at that. If you want to comment, you can. I know we're about out of time. Thank you.
So Representative Scott, let me just say that we both value family and know the importance of both parents being in children's life, but that's something we also have to talk about because there's a history there that is foundational for America and the removal of children and removing of parents from households through many types of different acts. So I agree with you. Let's continue to do this work on behalf of, you know, children and families across the state of Minnesota. You know, ask yourself, you know, as we think about what does this look like through a racial equity lens, how strong are we create your process as legislators for BIPOC communities. And with that, we are adjourned.